Okay. Welcome to the Sunday night. There is a solution, newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. This meeting is being recorded, so you may visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The link will be posted in the chat. The opinions expressed are those of the individual OA member. Are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Our speaker today is a compulsive overeater, a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered to the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After the share, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. So please join me in welcoming Cheryl L., a compulsive overeater from Florida.
There we go. Got my timer going. I'm in good shape. Can everybody hear me okay? All right, excellent. My name is Cheryl L. I am a compulsive overeater. I am recovered for today, and I live in the state of Florida. And I can't tell you what an honor it is, an honor and a privilege to be asked to share how I recovered, using the Big Book and using these steps of recovery. I'd like to start my share with a prayer because this was something that was taught to me early on. And it's an important thing for me to remember before I start to speak. It's called the set aside prayer. God, today, help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my own recovery, so I may have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. Please help me to see the truth. Amen. So I'm going to share a little bit of my history with eating, just so that I really do qualify to be here. I won't delve into it for too long, but I think it's important that you have something that you can identify with. And I'd like to extend especially a hearty welcome to anyone who is new to the program of Overeaters Anonymous. We are so glad you're here, and we really hope that you find in this program, the release that you seek from your addiction. It has happened for many of us. It has happened for me, and today I can say that I am neutral with my food. And I prefer it that way. It is so important that I continue to do the things that I was taught early in recovery, and I can't let up on my spiritual program of action. So I think I was a compulsive eater really from the get-go. My parents used to tell me a story about my grandfather buying my baby food for me because my parents didn't have a lot of money. My dad was working full time, and my mother was a stay-at-home mom. And I used to go through cases of baby food. I would eat 3 jars at each meal, and I guess that was kind of unusual. I don't really know, but yeah, what, a year old, and I'm already compulsively overeating because it was just in my DNA, and that I think that was one of the first things that I had to learn when I came in. Was that it wasn't that I was, I was a bad person trying to get good. I was a sick person trying to get well, that I had this disease. I had this allergy, this addiction. Some of my earliest memories were of, being in my first communion dress when I was 7 years old. And I already looked pudgy, at seven. I was showing those signs of pudginess. My mother would tell me about, how I had an affinity to eating the meringue off the top of the lemon meringue pie, and licking the spoon, from the batter bowl for the brownies or the cake or whatever it was that she was making. My earliest memories going out to eat with my grandmother were going to a restaurant where I had all kinds of sweets, pancakes and hot chocolate and just, all of this good stuff. And it just seemed like I could never really get enough of it, even as a child. I never liked to exercise, and so all of that stuff really piled on me, very, very quickly. And I had weight issues from a very young age. I was constantly going up in size, and my dad would try different things to get me to, just try to move more, be more active, so that I wouldn't gain the weight as much so quickly anyway. I think my eating took on, as it talks about in the big book, the series, it took on more serious proportions during my middle and high school years, because I started sneaking food, and that was the time when I would be able to get home from school before my mother did, and I would be, scooping things off the top of the ice cream container, just trying to take just a little bit so that she wouldn't notice that any of it was missing. So that kind of stuff was happening. I was looking for snacks as soon as I walked in the door. I was using my lunch money to buy candy from the school store when I started going to a school that had a store in it. And then one year, I spent all of my lunch money on candy. And at the end of the year, my parents got a bill for all the food I had eaten in the cafeteria that I never paid for. I was starting to have these consequences for my actions at a very young age. Obviously, my parents were not too happy about those kinds of things. I was an underachiever in phys ed class. I was always the last one picked for for any of the teams. I was 185 pounds in my senior year of high school, and I didn't like the way I looked. I would try different things. I would try a new haircut. I went to a hairdresser for the first time when I was, getting ready for my senior prom, and that helped my self-image a little bit. But really, the rest of it was just try to hide the fat, just wear clothing that they wouldn't see what was underneath my clothes. I went to college. I did, get grades sufficient enough to make it into college. And by the time I got into being a college freshman, I had my first job, and it was working at a donut shop. And so you can just imagine how the weight piled on with that. I was, struggling to just eat two donuts on a Saturday, not eat more because I really wanted more, and would get all the leftover donuts on Sunday. So who was game for that. It was bad. It was really bad. And around the time that I turned to be legal drinking age, now I discovered drinking. And so now I'm drinking and eating, and reached my top weight at 225 pounds when I was a sophomore in college. And school was kind of like an afterthought. I was much more interested in, seeing how I could make myself feel better. Because that's what was all underneath this. I didn't feel good about myself. I was raised in a dysfunctional family, unfortunately. Hey, we all are, right? We all have dysfunction of one way, shape, or form. And I was just covering up all of those feelings that I had with food and with alcohol. And it was a very it was a very tough time in my family. My sister left home, and I worried sick about her, and I just ate and drank more over that. It seemed like no matter what was happening, my solution was to eat and to drink, and it wasn't getting any better. Life was not getting any better. I started to try to lose weight probably in the mid 80s. I went to all of the pay and weigh places that you know about, and it seemed like I just had this cycle, that we've heard about. It's a cycle of, get up close to 200 pounds, go to one of these pay and weigh places, lose 30 or 35 pounds, just enough to make me feel a little bit better, and then I'd be back in the food again. Because the solution was never, stopping eating this food on a forever basis. The solution was, let me just do it until I can get to a decent body weight, and then I'll enjoy it again. So it was always, restricting my access during that time. So this cycle continued for probably a good 30 years, and it brought me to Overeaters Anonymous for the first time in the year 2011. So by now I'm in my early 50s, okay, and I've definitely achieved things in my life. I've been married Now I was married to my second husband. I've gotten a couple of college degrees. I'm working a professional job. I have a lot going for me. And in 2011, I had already been sober for 12 years. And so I had that going for me. But I was going to maintain control over my food no matter what. I mean, it was in my blood. I was raised Italian. And that thought was always there that eating healthy or eating well was a good thing. You never left your plate. You never left your plate with food on it, or else you wouldn't get dessert. And if you didn't like what you were eating, then you just disguise it. And I figured out all these ways to eat the foods that I really didn't want to eat, but I had to eat. And so by 2011, though, I was back up and I was having to go into a new clothing size once again. And I had my youngest niece living with me at that time. And she said to me, Auntie, don't do it. You can do this. You've done it before. You can lose the weight. Don't buy the extra size clothes. And for some reason, that really hit home with me that I had to try again. And I had a fortunately at that time I had a sponsor in my other program that was also in OA, and I had seen how she had kept the weight off, and I had seen a little bit of how she ate. She didn't make a big deal about it, but I knew there was something different about her, and so I finally called her and I said, look, I've got to do something about my eating. It's out of control, and she got me to my first OA meeting back in 2011. Now, what I did during that time was that I treated OA really as a weight loss program with group support. I could see I was overweight. I could see I was having physical issues. And now I'm getting into my step work here. A lot of my physical issues were aches and pains. I was carrying around an extra 50 pounds. And I just felt like I was slowing down a lot faster than I ever expected. My sponsor back then encouraged me to follow her food plan, which I did. I attended meetings in that program twice a week, and I continued to work the steps in my other program. And I think this is one of the key things for me, in terms of, my credits don't transfer. And I've heard that. That's not a Cheryl original. That comes from my vision meeting. My credits don't transfer. I have membership and two fellowships. I have to work those steps in different ways, and I have to look at my substances in different ways in both of those programs. So when I went through the steps this time with my new sponsor, I had to substitute the word food for alcohol. I had to substitute the words compulsive eating for alcoholism. I really had to treat this in a different way, and I had to look at all of the things that were a part of my compulsive eating. I had to look at the foods themselves, and I had to also look at the behaviors. And the behaviors were a big thing for me. I was eating in the car. I was eating, in the checkout line. I was eating away from the dinner table in front of the television. I was getting up in the middle of the night to eat, and I was having snacks all the time. It was just nonstop eating, by the time I got here. And so I had to look at that. All right. But the unmanageability of my life was a little bit harder for me to understand because I had no I thought I was doing pretty well, all things considered. Everything from the outside looked okay. Yeah, my body didn't look great, but everything else looked pretty decent. And I had the love of my husband no matter what. He didn't care that I was, that I was overweight. And we used to kind of laugh about it. And I would say to people, yeah, I'm fat. I'm happy and fat, and that was one of the excuses that I made, one of the rationalizations that I had. And I had to talk about that in my step one work. What were all of the excuses that I came up with, to rationalize my continuing to stay the way I was? I went back into the food, I'll tell you. After being abstinent for about 5 or 6 years. And the reason I went back into the food was because I started telling myself these lies. I know how to eat well. I like eating well. I like eating healthy. I just don't feel like I have to write it down anymore. I don't feel like I have to measure my food or weigh my food. I don't feel like I should have to tell somebody what I'm eating every day. I don't feel like, you know, it was like all this, I don't feel like stuff. You know, life had gotten really good for me. And all of those things that had kept me abstinent to begin with had slowly started to slip away. So by the time I relapsed in a big way, the only thing that was there was the food. That was all that was left, you know, that was going to go. Everything else, spiritual practices, you know, any of that were going by the wayside. And so I went back into the food. Something happened in 2022. I'm glad you're finally glad that I got to this point, right? Because now there's only 3 years left, right? I found my way into vision, and I actually had been in vision before, and I didn't even realize it until I started getting ready for this talk, and I came across journals that I had written, and I had been in vision and never even realized that I had done it until I came back in 22. You know, the mind had to be clear. I had to get out of the food for a good, you know, period of time before my mind started to clear up. And then I could finally hear the message that was going to be delivered to me. And it was the message of wait. You know, we talk about, you know, frothy emotional appeals seldom suffices. The message had to have weight and depth. And when I came back to vision, when I came back to Ovaries Anonymous in 22, something clicked for me. You know, I had a new sponsor at that point. I started listening to the meetings almost every day. And then I was working the steps thoroughly. You know, doing the things that she told me to do. You know, and it was at that point that I recognized that just putting down my food was not going to be the end all and be all of this program. You know, that was the beginning point. I needed to change, and I needed to change from the inside out. I needed to have more conscious contact with my higher power, and I needed to work with others. You know, and I'm going to be 100% honest with you. There was a point where my sponsor fired me. And it was after I had finished working the steps, and I wasn't sponsoring, and she finally got she called me on it, and she said, "I can't help you if you're not helping others." She said, "There's nothing left for me to do with you," and she let me go, and I went without a sponsor for a period of time, but then I really, you know, I woke up. I woke up. This had to stop. I couldn't go on like this. I could see that I was going to end up where I was before. So what did my step work look like? My step work looked like this. I would read the text that was assigned to me. I would highlight, underline, sometimes circle words and phrases in the big book that I wanted to learn more about. I had to have a dictionary by my side. I would look up words and I would write down the definition of those words. Once I was done with that chapter or whatever the reading assignment was, I would present it to my sponsor. I would tell her what I was getting out of it. And then she would point out anything important that she thought I needed to take a look at as well. She gave me podcasts to listen to, which I would listen to, and I would write. This is very important for me, is to pay attention, to not be distracted and not try and be, you know, doing multitasking, was to really pay attention and to write down what I was getting out of these podcasts. Our work through the big book did take quite a long time for me. I was back in college again, going for another bachelor's degree, which I didn't need, but I was really interested in. So I did that, and I was working full time. So the work that we did together did take from September until the following June to complete. And what I did for tonight's talk was I just kind of went through the chapters of the book and just brought out some of the things that meant a lot to me. We started with the preface, and I read the preface and the forewords to the first four editions of the big book. And what I got out of that was that the history of AA, its growth, how the traditions developed, and what the whole purpose of the book is. The whole purpose of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is to describe how the writers recovered. So this book is our directions on how to recover from our disease. And it goes for Overeaters Anonymous, it goes for compulsive eaters just as well as it does for alcoholics. One of the most important chapters in this book for me was the doctor's opinion. because for the first time I was able to really see the double whammy, in that chapter. I'm sorry about the chime on the clock. I can't do anything about that. The double whammy, we have the mental obsession and the physical compulsion. I can't stop from starting, and once I've started, I can't stop. So that was very important for me to learn. I love Bill's story. I've always loved Bill's story because I could always find the places in his story that where his disease was progressing. And for me, the favorite part of every story in the big book, Bill's story included, is that place where the transformation happens. Where that it's that turning point that we read about in chapter five, how it works. We stood at the turning point. I learned of all the things that didn't work for Bill, and I could relate to that. His fear didn't work for him. High resolve didn't work for him. Self-knowledge, self-sufficiency, none of those things worked for him. And I could relate to that because none of those things worked for me either. I had a fearful thing happen, before I came in, and it was I went for a colonoscopy, and I'm sorry for saying that word, but it's definitely necessary, and the results of it weren't good. They were really, really not good, and so it was important for me to really hold on to that fear, and try to remember that as I went forward. In the chapter, There's a Solution, I saw how important it was to connect to other compulsive overeaters who were living in recovery. This was something that was really missing for me the first time. I had to learn from my mistakes, learn from what happened before, and to figure out, what it was that I needed to do differently this time. I love on page 25 in There Is Solution how it says what the whole program is all about. The whole program, in a nutshell, is laid out for us. Self-searching. I had to do that. I had to look deep within myself. I had to concede that I was truly a compulsive eater, that I was never going to go back to being a normal eater again. I had to level my pride. I had a lot of pride. I felt, because I had so much education, I really felt like I knew a lot. And that whole thing about setting aside everything I think I know meant that I had to be a little more humble. I had to get some measure of humility and to really listen to what others were saying to me. I had to shut off the buts, yeah, but I had to stop with that. I had to stop making excuses for why I wasn't doing the things I needed to do. I had to confess my shortcomings, and when I did my fourth step, I really tried to be as thorough as I could be. My sponsor did attest to that I did that I was extremely thorough. And I'll get to the whole thing about the amends later on, but it was kind of interesting how that all rolled out. I want to talk about we agnostics a little bit because I was raised in a faith. I had a very, very strong religious upbringing, and I even went to school, Catholic school, for 5 years because my parents were really trying to kind of impress on us the importance of our faith. And so I never thought that this chapter was important to me until I got into recovery. And this has become one of my favorite chapters because now I look at this chapter and I see, it's not, am I agnostic? It's where am I agnostic? Where am I leaving God out of this picture? Because one of the most important things I've learned in this is that God is walking with me every day. If I choose, God will walk with me every day. And my decisions have to be checked out with my higher power. Time and time again, when I'd go to my sponsor with a problem, she said, "Well, have you talked to God about it? What does God have to say?" So she was encouraging me all along to do that. How it works is where the big work starts. We look at step four. It took me a month to do my step four this time. I wrote out my resentments against people, against institutions, and against principles. I remembered very well the times that I would eat against a person. So, taking care of a feeling by eating over it was a big thing for me. And so now I had a chance to take a look and say, well, why was I eating over that? You know, what was it? What was behind that? And what I found most of the time was that it was fear of losing what I had or not getting what I want. You know, and the whole thing about playing the director, that really came to fruition for me. And looking at my defects, my defects became pretty glaring when I wrote out my fourth step. I played the director, I was a control freak, and I was perfectionistic in the hopes of warding off my fears. In my sex conduct review, I discovered that I just wasn't the partner that I wanted to be with my husband. You know, I was still letting him be my emotional caretaker, not to mention financial and all the rest of it. You know, and it was time for me to show up and suit up and be an adult, be a partner in this relationship. So I created an ideal, and my ideal was that I would be that partner that my husband deserved. He deserved to have somebody who was an equal responsibility. Another thing I really fought with a lot was procrastination, and procrastination is a big thing for me. If I couldn't be perfect at something, then I would put it off, and then I would be fighting. You know, and this is one of the things that I still work against today. And I'm asking God to direct my thinking with this, because this whole thing, you know, it only creates chaos. And procrastination is not my friend. I used to think that it gave me a lot of you know, that I would get excited about it all. That's not the case. I'm gonna really have to jump ahead, because I didn't think I was really gonna take this much time. But I just want to talk a little bit about the amends that I made. The amends that I made were primarily to family, although there were some people outside of my family. And it was a lot of taking advantage of people, okay? And there were some people that I had to make amends to who said, yes, you did that. And then there were others who were like, come on, I don't even really think that it was that bad. But I magnified it. I made it a lot bigger in my head than what it needed to be. You know, and that's one of the things about you know, doing this inventory, is that we realize that we're not the worst of the worst. We're not the best of the best. We're just, you know, kind of sitting comfortably in the middle. And I did, you know, I did have some really good results as a result, you know, doing these amends. I think the best one has been with my husband, because we're able to talk so openly and honestly, you know, today. And I know how to say I'm sorry quickly if I feel like I've offended him, or I've said something that was not kind. You know, my 10, 11, and 12 are very important to me today too. And this is the stuff that I'm working on a daily basis. I have a ritual now. I have a routine where I sit in the morning with meditation. My dear friend Bonnie sent me something quite a few years ago now that I listen to faithfully every morning. And I've been able to stretch that from the 5-minute short version to the longer version. And then I sit and do some additional reading and writing afterwards to extend that meditation time. It's helping me to get in conscious contact with my higher power to start the day. I try to be mindful about gratitude throughout the day, and I capture those at the end. And then I also do a nightly review, which includes asking and answering those questions about where I was resentful, selfish, dishonest, and afraid. What could I have done better? Was I of service? Was I loving and kind? And I've done this, and I've passed this on to my sponsees, and they're passing it on to their sponsees. So it's a really beautiful process when we get to do that. And finally, I'll just share about working with others and really just being of service. Service has always been important to me. I've been doing service since I was new in sobriety back in 1996, and it's been a real one of those legs on the three-legged stool that keeps us all in balance. And so service has never been an issue for me. What has been an issue is follow through. Sometimes I sign up for too many things, and then I can't fulfill my obligation. So I've really had to be a lot more careful with that, and learning that I don't have to say yes to everything. That I really need to look at, you know, what's my motive? That's a very important question for me. And in keeping track of my obligations so that I don't shortchange anyone. The spirit of the chapter Working with Others, I love that chapter because it gives us some very specific instructions on how we are to work with others. But I'll tell you, the bottom line for me has been you get better with practice. And you don't, if you, it's like, you just got to keep doing it. I had to keep doing it. And I am not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. But at least today I can say I don't know everything. And I'm willing to learn, and I'm willing to learn from my sponsees, as well as from my sponsors, as well as the people that I speak with on the meetings. And I think that's all I'm going to share. I've got 24 seconds on my timer here. So thank you so very much. And if you want to talk more about anything that I've said, we're going to have some time for questions and answers now. Or please feel free to reach out to me. I am retired, so I have time. Thank you so much for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Cheryl. Thank you so much.